Majors & Quinn presents
Gina Wohlsdorf.
So tonight I'm very excited to welcome Gina Wohlsdorf to our store. She was born and raised in Bismarck. And she has lived a variety of places, including here in Minnesota. She has held a variety of jobs that afford her time to write, including a bookseller, which is always fun to hear as a bookseller myself. And after 2 decades of trying, apparently her novel's begun to make sense. And this is the result, is the super awesome debut novel, Security. And she has earned an MFA in creative writing at the University of Virginia, and now she currently lives in Colorado. Now, please join me in welcoming Gina.
I'm really tall for some reason. Hello.
Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for coming tonight. I'm really super excited to be here at Majors & Quinn. I remember a couple years ago, I came to Taya Obrecht's signing. Right? It was amazing. She was amazing. And I thought, wow, someday that'll be me here at Majors & Quinn. And we've arrived at that day. And I'm so happy. I'm looking around and I don't see any children in the audience. So with everybody's permission, I'm going to read a racy passage.
Yay!
Yes. But not till the end. So we will start out with a bit of basic background here. Security is the story of a hotel, and it is currently an empty hotel. Nobody has checked in. It's not open yet. So no guests, currently just a skeleton crew of employees who are getting it ready for the big opening. And here we go. On the 19th floor, Tessa is boarding the elevator. Its soft ding carries to the ballroom ceiling 30 feet above her and bounces off the mural there. A sunset sky in muted pinks and oranges, playing host to a dozen subtle and subtly modern cherubim. Their fleshy faces all stare down instead of up. The ballroom's enormous west-facing windows trap the earliest phases of an actual sunset. Bars of light and shadow, crosshatch tables set with china finer than bone. White napkins are folded in the shapes of swans, magnolias, seashells. Only a few are folded in the shape of napkins. A clutch of red roses serves as each table's centerpiece, and if a guest asks, staff is to confirm that the roses are from Manderley's garden, though they're not. Tessa placed a standing order with a florist last week to deliver 50 dozen every Monday. She holds the elevator's glass doors open with her left boot and takes a final look at the southeast corner of the ballroom, where Jules is holding the base of a 20-foot ladder. Jules' husband and catering partner, Justin, is finishing the pyramid of 1,000 champagne flutes they began at 7 this morning. At the party of the year, Charles Destin intends to climb this ladder and pour a bottle of champagne, the fizz of which will overflow the glass at the apex, to the 4 glasses under it, and so on, into 1,000 glasses. A thin plastic hose worms up through the pyramid. The hose runs to a storage room where 4 large tanks of champagne will finish the work that Destin's pouring will start. Destin compared the illusion of the single bottle of Cristal filling 1,000 glasses to the miracle of Jesus and his disciples feeding the 5,000 with 5 loaves and 2 fish. When Destin made this comparison, Tessa rolled her eyes so hard, one of her contact lenses fell out. In the elevator, she presses the button for the 11th floor. The glass doors slide shut, the 19th floor rises in front of her, and Tessa's posture slackens, an exhale showing in her shoulders. She's pretty, but not an obvious pretty. She tried modeling in college, because I'm a twig, she said once. And the photographers told her she only looked right in 3/4 profile due to a face that's a little long, a chin that's weak, and cheekbones that don't protuberate. Tessa's the kind of person who latches onto criticism, thankfully, and treats compliments like insults. It's infuriating. She makes a check mark on her clipboard as the 18th floor passes, and another as the 17th floor appears underneath her. The elevator is excruciatingly slow. This is because it is diamond-shaped and made of glass. Every day at 5 o'clock, Tessa descends from the ballroom to the foyer, scrutinizing each floor for problems, and the process takes an hour. She usually walks the halls, but she doesn't have time for that today. Her view from the elevator consists of the long hallway that links the north and south wings of guest rooms, the middle stem of a letter I, and this doubtlessly grates on her to check off the premises as passing inspection without inspecting them thoroughly. The front sheet of her clipboard shows a diagram of Manderly's layout, with floors numbered 1 through 20. The 20th floor is shaded. Tessa makes a check mark on her diagram for the 16th floor. She taps her boot impatiently. Before the 15th floor appears, she makes a check mark in its space. She pinches the bridge of her nose, her eyes falling shut and staying that way, which means when the 15th floor does appear, and Vivica in the bright white hallway spies Tessa in the elevator and waves, Tessa doesn't see her. Vivica is carrying a purple bottle of carpet cleaner and a white cloth, which she flaps ineffectually until Tessa sinks out of sight. Vivica's mouth draws down in disappointment. She walks toward the north end of the hall, turns left, and sinks to her knees in the entryway of room 1516. She sprays the carpet cleaner on a round red stain the size of a quarter and curses it in a flurry of Spanish. She thinks an electrician cut himself. This is not what happened. The killer is on the 7th floor. He's washing his hands in room 717, scrubbing vivid red from his nail beds and knuckles into the bathroom sink. He picks a fine, light hair from his shirt cuff, studies it with brief interest, and flicks it behind him. It lands on the white bath mat. The water in the sink is paling from a strange, swirled red-orange to a shade that matches the gold leaf of the taps. A knife the length of an average man's forearm is drying on a white towel beside the basket of assorted guest soaps. Tessa opens her eyes at the 14th floor, nods, and makes a firm checkmark. She waits and makes another for the 12th floor. There is no 13th floor. Charles Destin is extremely superstitious. So as will happen in a horror novel, things go to hell in a handbasket. And what you need to know for this next session is that a lost love of Tessa's comes back, and his name is Brian. And they rekindle quite aggressively in the elevator in the part I'm about to read. And the killer has cycled his way through a few employees and has wound up with a lovely maid named Dolores. But Dolores is not going down quietly. The killer tackles Dolores. She hits her head on the dance floor. She moans, face down. She's inches short of the gun. The killer thrashes up Dolores' body, seizes the revolver, and flips the chamber open. He sprinkles the bullets and tosses the gun. It bounces once before landing in the storage room. The killer pulls Dolores' scalp backward to beat her skull into the floor, but Dolores rears like a bucking mare and throws an elbow into the side of the killer's head. The killer rolls off her. Dolores stands and runs for the kitchen, dizzy, her limp more pronounced. The elevator is on the 9th floor. Tessa balances on one foot, ass on the railing. Her other foot has stepped from her underwear and hangs over Brian's shoulder. Brian's neck and head are cloaked in her skirt. Tessa says his name. His name rises in pitch. It's as if Tessa is birthing him. One might prefer to think of the tableau as something ludicrous, like Tessa birthing Brian, rather than to admit the two of them are building something noble and lovely and sacred, something that will last, so long as the two of them are not hacked to pieces tonight. Dolores slaps the kitchen door open. She yanks a trash can over behind her. It's large and gray and rubber and full of disposable accoutrements slick with cherry coulis. She runs for the walk-in refrigerator. The killer slaps the kitchen door open, but he doesn't see the trash can and goes flying over it like Superman, his hands splayed out, and Dolores is digging in her apron pocket for the secret elevator controller she has never used. She was told never to use it except in extreme emergency. This qualifies as an extreme emergency. The killer lands and skids through red gobbed paper towels and chunks of wax paper. Dolores finds the controller and presses the button. The juice concentrate moves too slowly. Dolores shuts the door to the walk-in refrigerator and pulls on a shelf crammed with tubs of peppers and fresh fruit. She grits her teeth and makes a sound like a creature giving birth. Tessa makes a similar sound in the main elevator. Brian's head, under her skirt, moves both gently and powerfully at once, like waves. Red and green peppers fall to the walk-in refrigerator's floor. The killer shoves at the door. He's unable to open it, but he is able to reach inside through a gap. He is slicing at the air with his knife. The juice concentrate has moved mostly aside, but Dolores isn't looking in that direction. Dolores is instead snatching a pair of kitchen scissors off a nail. The scissors are there to open plastic pouches of refrigerated material. She raises the scissors and strikes toward the killer's exposed arm. The killer sees this and flounders to pull back. He succeeds. Dolores turns. Dolores screams. Tessa is getting close. The elevator is coming up on the 12th floor. Tessa is trying to hide the fact that she is weeping. She is wiping her temples free of tears, the tears on her temples because she is staring up at the ceiling as if she sees God in that apex of glass. She has hiked her skirt high enough so she can look down and watch Brian's efforts. She begins to breathe erratically. She says Brian's name twice. Her pussy shoves at his face like she can't help it. She can't help it. Brian keeps his pace steady but hikes her skirt higher. He ups the pressure of his tongue. Tessa screams.
Thank you. Any questions?
An audience member asked Gina to explain a reference in the book to the day that she almost died.
The day I almost died was June 10th, 1994. I was 13 years old. I have the scar right here. I was at an aerobics class, oddly, at the Y at age 13. I know, as you do when you're 13. And I was jogging home because the aerobics class just wasn't enough. I weighed like 4 pounds. I don't know what I was doing. But anyway, I'm coming home, and there's Washington and Divide, an intersection in Bismarck, North Dakota. And I didn't look at, I had this weird aphasia all my life about don't walk signs. I just didn't look at them. It drove my mother absolutely batty, and she told me so many times as a kid, you are going to get hit by a car. I was like, all right. So this day, I cross the street. I'm about 3/4 of the way across, and I hear bah, bah, really loud, right? I turn to the right, and the last thing I see is a white hood of a car. And then I flew, and I remember it in real time. There's no blackout. There's no pause or anything. The sky and the ground switched places. And I remember thinking, boy, that's strange. I even had time to think it, different. And then I landed. And I landed face down in the gutter, but I landed like this. So arm right up to my forehead. And the gutter snapped my arm clean in half. And I mean, I looked up. Oh, yeah. It was glorious. And I looked up and I looked over and I saw my arm in two pieces. And you have to understand that I was a kid who was terrified of everything. I was scared of everything. I feared cats. I feared spaghetti sauce. I mean, name it. Car upholstery. I thought car upholstery was so creepy. It was too thready. It was shiny. It was like, what's in that? But seeing my arm like that, I was like, this is what you're really afraid of. This is what you've really been afraid of this entire time. And something in me spoke up and went, but you're, honestly, you're kind of fine. I mean, I looked around and this voice in my head, like half of me is like, rah, I'm screaming. But there is a voice in my head that's going, you're okay. It's a nice day, you know? It's not snowing. That's nice. This is North Dakota. It could be, you know? You're face down in a gutter, but hey, could be worse. Yeah, right? You just start thinking in actual details. And I said to the woman who was crouched over me, she'd thrown a blanket on me. I couldn't look at my arm. I had my eyes squeezed shut tight the entire time. And she said, what can I do? And I said, call my mother. And I told her my phone number one digit at a time. And I said, call my mom and tell her I'm okay. Even if I die, tell her I was okay. And after that, I had a hard time being afraid of anything.
Did you start working on the novel immediately after?
Oh, gosh, no. Oh, gosh, no. I did not start working on the novel right after getting out of the hospital. I started working on making my way through every horror film I could get my hands on for some odd reason, and I became a giant fan of The X-Files. And, you know, from there, and read everything Stephen King wrote, and just started being really fascinated by fear and mortality and sort of the threat of that, but also how once you're in it, you really are kind of okay. And you find this part of you that's just like, well, we're here. In the worst of the worst, we're here.
Who came up with the clever formatting for this book?
So the format, thank you very much. The split screen that happens is, of course, different security cameras. But I got that idea from workshop. I was in grad school for my MFA and having a workshop with Ann Beattie, a very, very renowned short story writer. And she's a wonderful workshop leader because she kind of just inundates you with all this different information and you can just kind of snag on whatever you want. So I doubt she even remembers saying this, but she said, yeah, this one time I read a book where the page split and you had to decide what you wanted to read more. Oh. So kind of a literary choose your own adventure, right? And that stuck in my mind because I was thinking of security at about the same time. I was reading another novel for another class that had given me the voice for the narrator. And so those two things just kind of congealed. I mean, if nothing else, grad school definitely gave me that, you know, gave me those ideas that came together just at exactly the right time. The four columns being kind of looking like a, what do you mean? Having to turn the book in the galley. So my publisher did that and showed it around and people said that looked too weird. So then they did the split that was four ways. And I was just like, it's fine as long as we get splits. Yeah, that was really important to me. Did I write it that way or did I restructure it? I did write it exactly that way. And then it got to design. And design kicked it back to me to say, you know, does this look right? And they were of varying lengths. And I wrote back and I was like, no. They've got to be flush bottom. Everything needs to end at the same point because that gets the simultaneity across of the various cameras. Also, there's a point where a vase is thrown at somebody's head, not by the killer, by normal people. This is happening elsewhere in the hotel. Yeah, right. Eventually, it's sitting there. Throw the vase. I said those words need to be in exactly the same spot in both blocks because it's happening at the same time in both blocks. So I was very persnickety about it. And it's a layer that I'm not even sure anybody cared about but me or cares about but me. Thank you. Thank you. People care. Did I enjoy the killer scenes or the sexy scenes more? I love writing sex. Come on. It's so much fun. I learned on a book that was just like beginning to end sex, and that book never worked, but it did teach me that craft. But the killer is fun to write too, from the perspective that he's kind of the most human. We see him do laundry. We see him have a snack. We see him take a nap. We see him go to the bathroom. We see him throw a tantrum. We see him do all these, you know, average everyday things that a normal person would do. And we don't really see that out of the other characters. The other characters have much more dramatic, nuanced lives. But this is a guy who's just going to work, you know? I guess the answer, I loved playing them off one another.
How did you manage to keep the split POV pace so well and make the timing seem so believable throughout the story?
Yeah, the simultaneity or the chronology staying real time. That's a very good way to put it, real time. Really hard to do. Let me tell you something, really hard to do first time. Brutal in revisions because your editor comes back to you and says, there's the characters who just aren't well developed enough. Jules and Justin, right? He came back to me and said, Jules and Justin need more development. And I was like, oh, Chuck, you're killing me. Where do I put this? Because, I mean, if you add stuff in, it makes a lump, right, in the time frame. And that's where the splits really saved me because I just added a column. I was like, okay, well, I can go through and try and decide what they're doing here. And really, his affair and Jules's pill addiction came out of that. And I was like, I can fit that in these. And I had to be, it was just tweezer work. It was so hard. And I'm used to backhoe. I mean, I love working. I love getting just gigantic amounts of writing done in a day, you know, but this was, I can add a line here. It was really hard. It took a long time.
Is the hotel named after the novel Rebecca?
Yes, Manderley. Yes. The influence of Rebecca was super duper important because that's a horror novel with zero supernatural about it. It's the most amazing thing to read. I can't believe Du Maurier pulled it off, but it's the scariest thing you've ever read. And at no point does she say there is a poltergeist at Manderley. Of course, it's this book about this woman who marries this gentleman and goes back to his house and beautiful, beautiful manor in England. And he's a widower, so his wife is dead. And her you know, her influence just seems to hang over everything, and everything's red because she loved red. All the flowers are red. And it's spooky. It's so spooky. Rebecca is the most interesting character in Rebecca, and she is toast from page one. She's not there. So to write like a negative, invisible character like that, of course, is what I'm doing here too, except he's still alive and he moves up through the novel.
What does Nodak mean?
Nodak. So my acknowledgments, I have a thing with acknowledgement sections in books. You know how you're so into a book and that ending happens and you're just like tears and you turn the page and it's acknowledgments and then it's the author's voice talking to you saying, I'm the author, hello. And I mean, bless authors. That's okay. That's fine if you like that. I just, every time it takes me out. And you'd say, Gina, just don't read the acknowledgments. What's your problem? But if there's print on a page, I have to read it. So I thought, how do I get around that? And I thought this was the perfect book to kind of like try this technique where it's just a grid and it's just a list. And it's arranged by place because I've lived so many places. Nodak is North Dakota. Yeah, MSP is here, of course. And both of them are sitting right there. That's Danny, that's Steve. Danny's one third of my dedication page. Yeah.
And OTH?
OTH is other.
OTH is other.
Yeah. Because they're not, you know, I couldn't put them in a place. And I thought of just saying, Stephen, Daphne, but then I was like, nobody's going to know what that means. They're just going to think that they're, you know. I know, yeah. Stephen, Daphne, Shirley. The hotel, what was the genesis of the story? The hotel itself was first. I got the idea, actually, when I was roommates with Danielle. And I thought, I think we just recently watched Halloween, and I'd seen Halloween like 20 bajillion times. And I think I even said to you, how come there's not a book of this? How come this isn't a book? How come this doesn't have an equivalent in book form? And she was just like, write it. Yeah. Right. Whenever I complain to Danielle, this doesn't exist. She's just like, well, make it. Why are you whining? So I sat down and I drew a map of Manderley, like right away. I was like, 20 floors. There's a pool here. There's ocean. There's a maze. Great. And I looked at it, and it's happened so many times when you get an idea that quickly. I didn't know how to execute it. I had no idea. I tried. I sat down and I wrote like a page and I just stopped. I was like, no, that is toxic and awful. That's why this doesn't exist in book form, is because, I mean, when you take a movie and try and make it into a book, I mean, novelizations of films, you can see what happens. Like the POV just doesn't gel quite right because the camera doesn't translate to the page. It's just not the same thing. So I needed some way to do that. And so I put it in my folder and it sat there for 3 years. And then I was in grad school, and a professor of mine had us read a book called Jealousy by Alain Robbe-Grillet, who's also in my acknowledgments. It's a super weird POV experiment about a gentleman who thinks his wife's cheating on him in France, but Robbe-Grillet was an experimentalist in the 50s, and he wrote the whole thing, start to finish, first-person narrator, without ever using the pronoun I. Blew my mind, because what he would do is he would say, there are four chairs on the porch. He is in one, she is in another, one chair is empty. So you'd read that and you'd go, okay, so there's somebody in that third chair. Who is that? And the logical assumption is that that is the narrator. He pulls that trick over and over and over and over again. And I mean, it gets kind of annoying after a while, but it's amazing. It's amazing that he was able to do it. And I thought, God, what if you married that to a really cool story? And then I thought of my map. And I thought, okay, so somebody's watching this. That's what it is. And then I got the voice and then got the split screen. Did I revise back from anything? No, I did not. I had, you know, I had that one page. Right. And there, who's telling the story the whole time? Initially, I didn't really reveal it. I didn't reveal it to the last 5-6 pages. And it was my editor, actually, who was just like, can we move him up gradually, gradually, gradually? Can we get back to the maze somehow, gradually, gradually? And he was right. Smart editor.
Who was the editor?
Editor was Chuck Adams. He edited Water for Elephants as well. Any other questions? Alrighty, Roo. So I go to the place.
Go to the place. You were awesome.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.